Hey everybody, welcome once again to DWP's Restaurant High AP webinar series. Our theme this week is come out and play, because we're ready to come out and play and enjoy coming back to restaurants wherever permitted around the country at this moment under a phased in modified schedule with protective gear and everything else. I don't believe anybody on this call believed we'd be talking about this 3 months ago at this time, but hey, here we are. And thank you for joining. Looking forward to another action-packed session today. We've got a great lineup and really appreciate all of you taking the time to join us today. This is Riley Loggison, the National Restaurant Industry Practice Group at Davis Wright Tremaine. We're fortunate to work with many of you on the call and obviously happy to assist you with navigating any of these issues that you're facing, finance, employment, real estate, regulatory, otherwise. We're all in this together and we're all going to get through this and come out strong. So purpose of this session is to provide some great content, some idea sharing, have guests that are really committed to the restaurant space that can share their experiences and their ideas to get everybody back together stronger here. Wanted to give a quick recap of the Nacho Showdown that took place last Friday. Friday afternoon, if anybody saw on Facebook Live, it was a lot of fun. Very
Hello? I don't know if people can hear me.
Yes, we can hear you, Gwenna. Thank you for jumping in. We're just having some technical difficulties.
No worries. I will just go ahead and jump in since we can't.
Thank you.
Hopefully he can join us. Hi, everybody. My name is Gwyneth Borden. I have a consulting company called Ground Floor Experiences, and I'm on the steering committee of the Bay Area Hospitality Coalition, which was one of the many coalitions that formed around the country among restaurant operators, employees, and others who are looking for a way to help provide resources for the industry and also advocate on behalf of restaurants who are in a very unique position given COVID and the mission of what restaurants do and what they mean to communities. In that work, we ended up having conversations with State Senator Scott Wiener, who has been a great champion for small business. And he and State Senator Lena Gonzalez from Long Beach had already introduced a bill that was a commercial eviction moratorium bill. And I have been in contact with Senator Wiener about various legal theories looking at force majeure that's in some leases, frustration of purpose, interoperability, and kind of really looking at a way to create better leverage in the landlord-tenant relationship to get to better outcomes. We were hearing a lot of feedback from a number of operators that were having a really hard time getting their landlords to work with them on reasonable leases. In general, real estate rates had been very high, especially in the Bay Area for restaurant operators. They were ridiculous before COVID, and now they're just completely not doable, untenable. And so as more and more operators were increasingly panicked and having negotiations, you know, trying to have negotiations with their landlords and having their landlords not be very flexible or work with them at all, you know, it became really clear that there was a need to fix this problem. And Senator Wiener, since he already had this bill, he and Senator Gonzalez were eager to talk to us and figure out language that they could put into the bill that would actually help hospitality businesses specifically. So the first part of the bill, which is the original part of the bill, is an eviction moratorium in the state of California for all commercial tenants during the state of the emergency. It allows that if you don't pay your rent during that time, that you have to pay it within 12 months after the state of emergency back to your landlord. The second portion, which is the new portion, allows restaurants, bars, and entertainment venues who've seen a decline of 40% in revenue from pre-COVID and are looking at an ongoing reduction of at least 25% to be able to enter into a renegotiation period and notice their landlord that they want to have a conversation about their lease. It doesn't prescribe what that negotiation has to be. It basically says if they can't come to a mutually agreeable conclusion that the tenant can terminate the contract, have to pay the back rent for at least 3 months. If there's any pre-COVID rent, they would have to pay that as well. But basically allow them the right to terminate the lease and any sort of third party guarantees related to it. And the whole idea here is to create balance. It's not for people to walk away from leases and to leave their landlords with holding the bag. It really is about the opportunity for to get landlords to the table to really have honest conversations about rents that are completely, you know, not reasonable given the ongoing circumstances that we have. We're not going to have conferences or conventions. We're not going to have tourists. We're going to have reduced capacity. We're not sure about consumer confidence and all of those things. And so that's the crux of the bill. The bill will be heard in the Senate Judiciary Committee this Friday. Hannah Beth Jackson from Santa Barbara is the chair of that committee, and we're really working hard to get letters to the Senate Judiciary Committee. The deadline is today at noon, although I'm sure you can still continue to send letters to express support. We've seen broad-based support from around the state, all different kinds of businesses really eager to see this pass. We also obviously have a lot of opposition, primarily from the real estate industry, who classifies it that everyone's going to walk away from their lease not paying any money. obviously, that is not the case. And again, the goal really here is to give people a path forward for working with their landlord and encourage these conversations, which are unfortunately not happening very often. And often when they do happen, the terms are very unreasonable. And then the new contracts that people are being asked to sign, the waivers that people are asked to sign, are fairly unreasonable as well. So I don't know if there are if there are questions. Okay, I see. Well, this legislation.
Yeah, what if this is Riley? Hey, sorry about the audio issues. I am back on, so
great.
Apologize, everybody. And it's great to have you with us. And this is obviously a very hotly watched bill. I think from our feedback that we've been getting from our clients and friends, they really appreciate at least the idea of something like this, understanding that it will be opposed by the real estate community and others for obvious reasons. But I think raising at least the really important issue of finding a path forward between landlords and tenants, which has been central to discussion for a number of weeks since this happened, because the fixed price of real estate is the single biggest cost for most restaurants. And operating and with reduced volumes and restrictions and so forth, they're just not able to afford their rent. So, one question was, where did the 40% number come from, and how is that measured? Is there any specifics around the 40% reduction in revenue?
Yeah, so it's the months prior to COVID. And we went back and forth, should we do the whole previous 12 months and an average? But we just did right prior to COVID, primarily because of newer businesses that say if you had not been around the year before the same time. But we were looking at that as at least a significant amount of a reduction from previously, especially given that restaurant margins are very tight. And we also were trying not to make it overwhelming in terms of the number of people that would qualify. I mean, there are obviously some restaurants that are open just for takeout and delivery that are doing fairly well because their concept does really well with takeout and delivery.
Yeah, one question people have is, on this 40%, so there's a lot of people that have pivoted their models to doing more takeout and delivery. And on the third party delivery, a lot of them are generating revenue, but they're not exactly making money. And in fact, with the commissions, maybe some are losing money on that. So, would restaurants, precluded even if they show a revenue increase, from terminating a lease, even if they're not being financially viable with increased delivery, or how is delivery factored in, if at all, into the calculation?
The bill doesn't require that you have to show your landlord all your financials. I mean, I'm sure your landlord might ask for those sort of things, but it is basically looking at either an annualized or the months prior to COVID and the difference between those two in time in terms of the initial 40%, and then the 25% is kind of going is more related to capacity, right? Because restaurants are not going to be able to open at the same capacity that they were before.
Well, we know there's some questions out there. I know the senator was planning to call in and join. Not sure if he's going to be able to do that in the next few minutes. But you know, one of the questions, is, you know, what are the prospects of this passing Senate assembly and having the governor sign? I mean, where do you think this is going to shake out at this point, or is it too early to say?
So, I mean, it's a little early to say, but we obviously, the real estate community has, you know, done the NASCAR letter with all the logos where everyone's super involved. We are still having conversation with them. You know, we had a group last night at 5 p.m. We're really open to solutions, right? This is not like us versus them. We really do, if there is a mutually agree upon compromise, we're interested in that. But you know, at this point, we want to make sure that it makes it out of the Judiciary Committee. Even if it makes it out of the Judiciary Committee, then it goes to appropriations. What makes this bill a little more challenging is because it is an urgency legislation, it does require a two-thirds vote. So that makes it a little, that makes it, you know, more questionable about whether it can get through the process.
You know, how would this, has it been, you know, and maybe it's in the bill or been considered with respect to corporate or personal guarantees? That's a question we've had. You know, how would they be impacted? I guess one of the biggest reasons why restaurants are concerned about terminating is any individual liability or corporate liability. Would this essentially, you know, nullify any corporate or personal
Absolutely.
Guarantees?
Okay. It nullifies all third-party guarantees, whether it's your parents, yourself, your investors, your LLC. That was an important component that we put in there. If you never reopen, I see somebody has that question, then that's obviously the, you know, you've had 100% decline in your sales. And we have language in there related to, like, you have a decline in capacity either from, you know, basically it being mandated or that you don't feel comfortable for safety reasons, right? Because there are a number of restaurants who have expressed that they don't feel, even when they're able to reopen, that they don't feel comfortable reopening because we don't have widespread testing, because we don't have a vaccine, and they don't want to put their life and safety at risk, especially when the government hasn't made any, there's no identification and concerns around lawsuits related to people in COVID. So we did take that into consideration as well.
Yeah, we talked, you know, with a number of clients. We had a webinar on a few weeks ago on a path forward between landlords and tenants. And the idea, you know, was, you know, a phased in percentage rent as a workable model. I mean, that doesn't really answer the termination question so much, but at least a path forward potentially between landlords and tenants, at least for those that, you know, plan to stay in business or hope to stay in business, has been, you know, I think widely, you know, discussed as a model that could work. You know, there's been some pushback from landlords on that, as well as, you know, but the banking community in terms of, you know, lending on a percentage rent model and how, you know, banks are regulated, and, you know, it changes the way that they are, you know, would have to report things on their end. I guess in the whole kind of real estate world is applied to restaurants. I mean, are there other conversations about, you know, potential legislation going on with the senators, or you know, is this the primary legislation at the moment?
I mean, right now, he's obviously open, and other senators are open to doing things to help small business. I mean, the way that it works, you have to have an existing bill because the period in which introducing bills is already passed. So basically, you have to have a member who's willing to gut maybe another bill to change it to some other topic. So we had a unique situation because he'd already introduced a bill around this topic that we could actually tag on to. It doesn't mean that there couldn't be other bills. It's just more of a procedural process for how the legislature works. Mm-hmm. In terms of, you know, working with, like, the around percentage rent, I mean, you know, we were, again, really careful around not prescribing what the negotiation had to be. I mean, many people have said, can't we just have percentage rent, right? Like, that's what a lot of restaurant tenants would prefer. And, you know, for the legal soundness of the bill, we were trying to, again, leave it more open for the landlord and the tenant to decide what that would look like. But we obviously believe that percentage rent is probably the best path forward for a lot of people.
Well, and you personally, I mean, I've really enjoyed, you know, working with you and you know, seeing your success leading the Golden Gate Restaurant Association for a number of years. It's been tricky finding advocates, on the legislative side for years in California. You know, and it's a breath of fresh air, I think, for all on the phone to see efforts being made to support restaurants. With respect to, you know, other policies, you know, in addition to this, to support restaurants, are you and the senators receptive to a conversation about some of the other ideas to bring jobs and business back that we could help facilitate?
I mean, I would say he always is. So I think absolutely you can. I mean, you know, I myself am working also with the Independent Restaurant Coalition and doing a lot of advocacy around fixes to the PPP and the Restaurant Stabilization Fund asked for $240 billion. So that's, you know, that's at the congressional level, but that's something that I'm working a lot on. And if there are people who are specifically interested, we have some key targets in California, including Kevin McCarthy and Bakersfield and Judy Chu down in Los Angeles. And then we also have any Republican senator that we are also targeting for, you know, education. There's a lot of, you know, most elected officials don't understand the economic model of restaurants and how they work. And there's a lot of work to be done. And we really do believe that fixes to the PPP on the rehire provision, as well as the 75-25, which was in the HEROES Act change, would be substantial. But we also believe additional help is needed. And that's what the Restaurant Stabilization Fund, the $240 billion ask of Congress is. And I've actually said to the real estate industry here, who's opposing this bill, work with us on Congress, get us this Restaurant Stabilization Fund, and we can make sure you help get paid, right? So, you know, I am thinking creatively and working bigger picture on those sort of issues. And so if people are interested, they can definitely reach out to me, and I'd love to get them activated in helping to reach out to their senators on the key issues at the federal level, because obviously state and local governments are very much impaired from the loss of tax revenue. And all of them are talking about major deficits, state of California, $54 billion budget deficit. Lots of cities and counties in the same position. And so the federal government, in a lot of ways, in terms of actual financial aid, it's going to be our best option, because state and local just won't have that.
Yeah, and you know, we had served, you know, in Los Angeles on the Entrepreneur in Residence program for a couple of years prior to the pandemic. You know, Mario DePero and Ellen Chen of Mendocino Farms, you know, had led, you know, that initiative along with a lot of LA restaurateurs. And the goal was focused on helping, you know, with policies to fix some of the underlying problems that have been plaguing restaurants in Los Angeles and throughout California. I guess, you know, our perspective and those operating in California, the restaurant industry was on, you know, very shaky ground policy-wise going into this pandemic. And there are a number of other, you know, underlying problems that existed pre-COVID that have not been addressed. Do you think there's going to be an appetite, you know, from lawmakers for addressing some of those, you know, to help business move forward? Or
yeah, I mean, I feel like there's a great sense among a lot of state and local governments, especially realizing, I mean, California, God bless it, is a very tough business to do, a tough state to do business in, and there's a lot of well-meaning regulatory things. And I think for the first time, you're seeing a lot of state and local governments looking at how we can push things aside. And a great example just was with ABC's most recent fourth advisory, basically expanding that alcohol can be in conjunction with service in spaces that normally wouldn't be allowed, like outside and in parking lots and the like. So I do see that, at least in the short term, there's a real interest in kind of getting rid of bureaucratic and bureaucratic roadblocks, permits and fees. You know, whether or not that will last long term, we'll see. But I think restaurants, because of the unique position they play in, you know, whether it's shopping malls, shopping centers, downtown commercial corridors, or neighborhood commercial corridors, you know, everyone knows that we're kind of the linchpin that creates community and gets people to go to other stores and other businesses. So I think that there is a great degree of, you know, desire to help and to make things better. How long that will exist, I don't know.
Well, how can those on the call support the efforts, Gwyneth?
So great. So on the Bay Area Hospitality Coalition.com website, if you go to legislation, there's an advocacy toolkit and all the information you need to send. We have a draft letter, a tweet, an Instagram, an email that you can send to members of the Judiciary Committee. You can also spread the word. It's got all of the copy that you can use for a newsletter, anything to send out to all your friends. So, you know, getting letters to the Judiciary Committee first and foremost, focusing on the key members there in the advocacy toolkit. We have identified the key members that are on that committee in the various districts. And a lot of them are from Southern California. So people who are in San Diego, Orange County, Los Angeles, there are people there for you to target, and that would be great. Obviously, Lena Gonzalez, who's on the committee, is a co-sponsor. So she's supportive. And my understanding is that Hannah Beth Jackson, who's the chair, is supportive, but it wouldn't hurt to have her, who's from Santa Barbara, get some extra love from people in her district who are supportive of the bill as well.
Well, I know there's those on the call that are going to have questions, and please send them through the portal. And will you be able to hang on for a while to help answer questions?
Absolutely. And I know the senator is going to join at some point.
Yeah, if he can join, if you can just let me know when he joins so he can make a proper introduction, would really appreciate that. And I can tell you, you know, how much from the comments we're getting from clients all over the place, how much they appreciate this proposed legislation and the idea behind it, you know, to see lawmakers actually doing something that makes sense and to get the conversation moving ahead is absolutely critical right now, because as we all know, time is running out. It's yeah. finite in terms of saving these businesses, and things need to be done now as opposed to later. We can't kick this down the road much longer, and certainly appreciate you and the senators for proposing this. In any way those on the call can help with the conversation, I know they'd be happy to do it. So appreciate you joining. We'll keep you on here. If you have questions, anybody on the line, send them right through the portal, and Gwyneth can answer them. And when the senator joins, we'll make an introduction.
Great.
Yeah, thank you, Gwyneth. And as I was opening this session today and lost my audio, hey, it happens, right? So I was giving a quick recap of the Nacho Average Showdown between Guy Fieri and his son Hunter and Bill Murray and Homer from last Friday for the Restaurant Employee Relief Fund, which was a lot of fun. So if you didn't get a chance to see that, there's a link that was circulated, and the showdown raised a lot of money for a very, very important cause, in addition to highlighting the need to provide relief to restaurant employees around the country. So thank you to the Fiettis, the Murrays, Terry Crews, Shaquille O'Neal, and Carla Hall for their participation. It was a great time, and Salt and Straw did an amazing collaboration. Our great friends there with Terry Crews with the Nacho Average ice cream that can be ordered off their portal with a flavor pack. It's like a Mexican bright ice cream for adults is how they describe it. Delicious. So recommend everybody getting on there and getting Nacho Average ice cream pack for your family and friends. So with that, very excited to have our good friend, Chef J.J. Johnson, with us today. Many of you are familiar with Chef JJ's work as behind the Cecil restaurant in New York, as well as the Henry Culinary Institute of America graduate. JJ is also a James Beard award-winning author between Harlem and Heaven, and he is behind the concept Field Trip, which he has worked on for a number of years, which opened in 2019 in Harlem. And he is in expansion mode with Field Trip and looking for new opportunities. And it's really a dynamic concept. And JJ, we are happy to have you with us today.
Thanks, Riley. And I hope everybody's doing well and their families are doing well. I feel like my life lives on Zoom now. Or some type of online platform besides cooking in the kitchen and feeding people in need. Field Trip is a rice bowl shop. It's located in the heart of Harlem between 115th and 116th and Lenox. We opened up last July of 2019. We also have another location at the US Open tennis tournament with the USTA in partnership with Levy. And we'll be going there, fingers crossed or not, this year, which is up in the air and is a significant part of our business and sales, also in employment. I just wanted to kind of share with you, with everybody here, what I've been up to, what I've been doing. In the midst of COVID-19, most of my peers decided to close their restaurants, thinking that Corona would only be a 2-week or 3-week effect to their business. I never thought about closing the business because me and my team worked really, really hard on this. We were so new And I knew that if I closed the business, the brand was strong, but just not strong enough in the community yet, as people would still walk by us and try to figure out who we were or try our samples. But also, this was our proof of concept. This was something that we were proving to the world. And the cash, we only had but enough cash to last us in the bank at that moment for 3 months. And my wife being on the front lines as a nurse, you know, taking her advice to her seeing it front hand, was saying, you know, at this time, we're 3 months behind China. Pay attention to China, and that's where we are. So I said, okay, we have 3 months of this until we kind of get out of this super dark period, and how can I last? And I started to feed frontline workers directly in our community, taking food at that point when our sales were dropping, that potentially was going to go bad. And we fed a local hospital, Harlem Hospital, and I took it to Twitter and I said, hey, I just gave out 40 bowls to the ER room in Harlem Hospital, and this felt amazing. And people started to email, call from around the country, tweet at me from around the country to match me in the bowls that we gave out. And we created this, you know, donate a bowl program that was able to really bring back my staff, and we did it at cost. But what that did for us was that let us really connect with the community, which would have taken 2 to 5 years to do. We were able to connect with our media community. So we adopted all the hospitals in Harlem and the Bronx and Upper Manhattan, focused on feeding them, still being open for takeout and delivery. And we were doing 600 meals a day that were leaving out of our front doors to those hospitals. And as COVID has declined in New York City, I'm launching a foundation called the Field Trip Foundation. Field Trip Foundation will focus on feeding brown and black people with food insecurity. We'll have an amazing board that's put together. But in expansion, you know, the people now drive to us from the Bronx with their families for curbside pickup, something that we never had before, right? In the process of COVID, I went back to very old school methods. I put menus in the window. We took phone calls for pickup and delivery on the phone. I was personally doing delivery. My staff was doing delivery. And that opened up different streams of revenue. Taking pickup and delivery on the phone really was catering to a more elderly crowd that we were eliminating before. Menus on the window, people were walking by, and most of us in the fast casual space have these very clean windows, maybe with the sandwich board outside, but having these very cheap paper menus in the window were drawing people to come in that said, oh, I thought you were just selling rice. I didn't know you had shrimp and salmon and braised beef and crispy chicken and vegan ice cream. So it started to really, Field Trip really, in this old school method, was able to have more arms and touching the community, which was allowing people to come in. And we've been able with everything that we've lost along the way with our dining crowd, we've been able to hit the same amount of top line sales that we were hitting before, because the local community has been supporting us more than ever. And now I hope that when schools come back, construction comes back, that the combined of our old guests with our new guests will really push us to the top. I'm not opening my dining room, my 20-seat dining room, until after September 1, because I want to see what takes place in New York City. But I think in the darkest moment, I was able to find a little bit of light as I was catching anxiety through this process. And yeah, I believe that when we open up Field Trips in other communities, people will know that Field Trip will be here in your darkest times to help you in a pandemic, or if there's a hurricane or a tornado or earthquake, or if somebody just needs to get food, Field Trip will find a way to help you in need. So that's what I have today. Thanks for having me, Riley and team. And I hope
they can. Thank you, JJ. And one of the things, you know, that, I mean, you opened Field Trip to quite a bit of critical acclaim, you know, in 2019. And you said you drew people from, you know, all over the place to come visit. But this, as you said, it's really helped you connect with the community. And Field Trip, I mean, you're offering, it's high quality, chef driven, healthier, better for you, you know, things, you know, not the franchise, you know, fast food that, you know, exists.
Yeah, our rice comes directly from the farm. So we order rice directly from farmers. None of our rice is enriched or bleached. All of our rice is heirloom grains. Do we push that onto people? I've learned that. And me and Riley have had this conversation, is like the word healthy sometimes just scares people. So if people ask us, like, what's this black rice? Oh, this is China black rice. It comes from Anson Mills and it's freshly milled. Or our brown rice comes directly from a farmer in Texas. So we are supporting the farming community. I get a different farmer that reaches out to me at least once a month wanting to put their rice on the menu. But yeah, I took a big risk in a corridor in Harlem that our neighbors are Popeyes, McDonald's, and Taco Bell, and the Dominican restaurant. Those are our competitors. And what would make somebody come eat at Field Trip when you can go to Popeyes and get red rice and beans that is really delicious, I think is really knowing who we are, what we stand for, and the people that work here look like the community and is the community. So, you know, the people coming here are supporting their peers.
Well, and out of this, you're seeing some new opportunities and from developers, I understand, and the terms that, you know, are being proposed, you know, are seemingly far more attractive than terms that would have been proposed before this crisis. Are you seeing real growth opportunities for Field Trip that maybe you didn't see beforehand?
Yeah, I'm seeing amazing growth opportunities for Field Trip with really large New York City developers that probably would have never knocked on our door before or would have taken a little bit more time for me to grow on my own. I would say one of the biggest New York City developers, we're working with them right now for a second and third location. And also a lot of the deals are for us are looking really, really good. Percentage on rent, some upfront TI, develop spaces. Also, you know, I think a lot, it's sad to say, but a lot of restaurants are closing their doors that developers own, and they want to fill the spaces with brands or chefs that they believe in more than ever. I'm getting a lot of calls from the Bronx, Midtown Manhattan, Long Island City, Brooklyn. I've gotten calls from Allentown, Pennsylvania, Oklahoma City, a small town, which is not Oakland, a small place, like right outside of Inglewood, California. So we've been getting places from all around. When I first started this, I thought I would do 10 field trips and I would be really happy. At one point I said I would get to 50 when we started getting calls from places like Oklahoma City. Now I'm a big dreamer and a believer. If you know me, I believe we can get to 200 field trips, because we're able to work in a super urban area like Harlem or the Bronx, and be at a break even or drop money to the bottom, and alongside going to Midtown Manhattan and still be attracted to all types of people, all walks of life, because the brand really speaks to them.
Well, Chef JJ, really appreciate you sharing your experience with us, spending time with us today. You know, I think the message to, you know, all on the call today, there's, you know, the bright spots to be, you know, in the darkness out of this, you know, how to connect with communities and consumers in a new way, and a lot of growth opportunities are going to, you know, rise from what occurs, you know, with certain businesses closing. So if anybody has questions for Chef JJ, please send them through the portal, and thanks for spending your time, and best wishes on your efforts with you and your team and getting through this.
Thanks a lot, Riley. And what we say at Field Trip, I'll see you next trip.
All right. Thank you, Chef JJ. Talk to you soon. And Chef JJ, if you can hang on for any questions, that would be terrific. And
yeah, I'll be around.
We have Tim McHenry, founder and CEO of Cooper's Hawk. Many of you are familiar with Tim and Cooper's Hawk and their great work. Cooper's Hawk has really redefined the American wine and dining experience from the heartland of America, working from the inside out. Cooper's Hawk has always really impressed me, and Tim has as well, for obvious reasons, and how able to manage such a complex and sophisticated and dynamic business and grow it as he and his team have over the years in all these different locations so successfully. Cooper's Hawk was, been through a number of different successful financings, including a pretty significant one last year around this time. So Tim has really had his hands full with all kinds of things, and now he finds himself dealing with opening multiple locations and have a lot of, exciting new business things going on. And all of a sudden we have, this crisis that we're all working through. So Tim, great to have you with us today.
Thanks, Riley. Can you hear me okay?
Can hear you okay. I understand you are, holed up in Illinois right now. You prefer to be, on the water in Florida or someplace. But hopefully the floods aren't too bad there, and you're getting through it.
This is great. As I told you earlier, these calls, your call and a couple others I'm on, are for sure my therapy for the week as we, try to keep things afloat and keep rocking out. So thanks for all that you're doing, and it's great hearing all of our friends' voices since we can't be at the different conferences having drinking too much wine and telling war stories. So.
appreciate it, Tim. I've been thinking about you a lot because, there's very few concepts like Cooper's Hawk out there, highly differentiated and, so dynamic and so many sales platforms, but, obviously a lot of the business is done inside the four walls. So great to check in with you and just, know you're obviously doing some dynamic things to get through this. So how's it been going and what are you doing?
Yeah, well, we're doing what most people are doing. We're doing carry out, curbside delivery. We're blessed to have our wine club, 425,000 members that are, kind of like how JJ was talking about his community. That's our community. So they're sticking with us, and we're grateful for that. So we're selling retail wine, through the tasting room. No on-premise dining. By far, I am the farthest thing from a scientist that comes, but I do believe, I think most people believe, it's going to be around for a while. And we built this wonderful brand, like so many folks on the call have, and we're going to take it slow, because the likelihood that it gets worse before it gets better, I think, is a high probability. And nothing sounds more catastrophic to me in our company because of just kind of the size, having to lay off 6,000 people 11 weeks ago, than to start and then have to stop and restart again. So our philosophy is, we're hanging tight. We're monitoring every data point that we can. The Aries Group, our new partners, are absolutely exceptional, and they've brought resources, information resources that I didn't even know were available in the world. So that's been very comforting, and they couldn't have been better through this entire pandemic deal. So we're working the business every day. You probably all heard me speak on a panel here or there where I said, hey, we probably will never do delivery at Cooper's Hawk because it's really a brick and mortar experiential, concept. That's how we built the whole thing. And went from me stating that on wherever I spoke last to, getting a delivery platform set up in about 6 business days. So much for that idea, our wine club members and guests are happy that we have it going. We're I think doing what everybody else is doing. We're having conversations with our vendors, with our landlords. Happy to talk about that if you'd like.
Yeah, and, what are you doing with your landlord, Tim? Because obviously you have some very significant leases out there. And what's the approach and kind of how receptive have landlords been to work with you during this period?
Yeah, well, they've been very collaborative at the beginning, and I laugh when you say collaborative, significant leases. My bucket dream was to have a massive wine mecca in downtown Chicago, and so I was able to successfully pull off my life dream of a 3-story, 25,000 square foot 450-seat restaurant right in the heart of Chicago that sounded like a great idea last year, and right now it's going to be a workout. Our philosophy is, first and foremost, partner mentality. You know, our landlords have always been very good to us. I know that that's not everyone's experience, for sure, especially if you're in the, massive competitive urban markets. We're mostly in suburban markets and have been there since our inception 15 years ago. We're really just trying to, the biggest asset, I think, for us is taking our time. You know, everyone knows and has spoke to you, no one knows what's going to happen tomorrow, let alone a year from now with everything that's going on. So we're just slow and thoughtful this process, over communicating with our landlords. And now we're kind of getting into it. We engaged a real estate firm to help us coordinate these conversations thoughtfully. We have exceptional real estate people on the payroll at Coopersock, but we thought it would be great to really have some outside expertise to supplement their brilliance as well. So we're officially kind of one by one having conversations. We have, kind of like an A, B, C, or, we could probably live with it if we had to, but it's everything that we've talked about. It's abatement, deferral, and, the percentage rent concept. And we probably have a different request for, we look at each property differently based on volumes and location and the dollar rent number.
And how are you approaching? I know you have a number of stores in development. What is the status of things that you've broken ground on? Are you moving ahead or making any big shifts with those?
Yeah, we basically made a decision to kind of wrap them up in Saran wrap and keep them quiet. Scottsdale, Arizona is basically turnkey ready to open, but we're not going to do that yet. So it really is in our decision to kind of stay still and really kind of monitor the environment that forces us to manage every single dollar going out the door. So we shut down development at the moment. All the construction partners of ours are ready to get back to work as soon as we're ready. So we talk about it in our conversations, these what are going to be the demand indicators that, will make us feel comfortable about reopening and then ultimately continuing the construction of the new restaurants and getting back into a growth mode. And so what I said is it's kind of like the gentleman who taught me winemaking 20 some years ago is, great winemakers have a balance between art and science. If you've got a winemaker that just spends 100% of their time in the laboratory, you're going to get X quality wine. And if you got somebody, who's just all art and no technical ability, you're going to get that. So that's how we're thinking about it. We're monitoring, calls like yours give us great information about what everybody's kind of up to. We're watching the numbers. And then all of a sudden, I rely on our years in the business and intuition as to there's just going to come a time where art and science will meet up to say let's get back to work.
Yeah, and that's a great way of looking at it, Tim. I know a lot of at least states and cities are looking at phased in occupancy and these types of things as kind of a way to get restaurants back open. But we have a lot of folks that are just got being patient sitting on the sidelines waiting to get back on the dance floor until the music is right, so to speak. Is there, with respect to kind of any of the policies out there, does a phased in, if somebody says, well, you can open at 50%, does that mean anything to you necessarily, or are you just following your own script?
No, it does. It doesn't say to me, okay, well, because they, like right now we could open up our restaurants in Florida at 50%. We're not going to do that right now. We're going to watch and wait and be thoughtful. But with that being said, we're in a position that we're able to do that. Said to the story, I said, if this is, 15 years back and we just opened up our first Cooper's Hawk, hey, I'm with JJ. I'd be in the parking lot right now, selling the shirt off my back, making deliveries, and I'd be waiting on every person that wanted to come in and myself. So it's a very different ballgame. We've got one of the largest private equity groups in the world as our partner now. So we're young, right? So we got a while to go. So I'm just trying to really think long term And again, not everyone has that luxury.
Are you seeing any of the things that you've adopted for off-premise sales as something continuing, you know, once things resume to normal in terms of, you know, delivery, takeout, or any of these things that you might be exploring?
Yeah, no, for sure. It's here to stay for the world and for Cooperstock as well. You know, we kind of broke our approach into like four different phases. Number one was just survive, right? So we had to do all these horrific, catastrophic things in the first couple weeks of layoffs and furloughs and hunkering down. Then reopen. You know, we did close 100% for about 3 or 4 days. So then we reopened with carryout, curbside, and delivery. And now we're in what we call phase three, which is being great at carryout, curbside, and delivery. We've always had carryout, but we weren't great at it, you know. And I've always kind of, because it was such an on-premise, you know, experiential concept, Cooperstock is, I didn't embrace technology at the level that would have really come in handy right now. You know, when we talked about, you know, having iPads at the tables and such, I avoided all that like the plague, because I felt like people wanted to come and escape all of that. Well, so we were, you know, now behind the eight ball a little bit digitally, that we're working heavily on. So for sure it's here to stay. But I do think, as you know me very well, I'm incredibly optimistic. I think this is going to be a while, but I do think, you know, everything does come back to normal, whether that's in 6 months from now or 3 years. It reminds me, our CFO, Mike, he's a great guy. And he kind of shared his opinion that, you know, I do think people ultimately forget. It's like having a hangover or having, you know, children. You know, you're like, after you have it, you're like, well, I'm never going to do that again. But for whatever reason, we do it again. And so people do, you know, kind of forget and move on with their lives. And so it's a, you know, horrific time that, you know, none of us thought was ever conceivable that something like this could go on. But I'm optimistic, and thankfully we've got a lot of wine over here to keep us afloat.
Well, you know, one last question, because I know you have a hard stop coming up here, but you know, you and Cooperstock have always been really great with engaging with your customer and generating that loyalty. I mean, any tips, you know, that you can provide to those on the call, you know, as they're working through this, how to really, you know, engage with their customer, you know, to bring that loyalty into play?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's kind of like what I say, you know, we've got this great business model with the wine club. So, of course, that's a huge aspect of our success. But at the end of the day, I think our success is that we focus on the right stuff every day, taking care of people, our team members and guests. We're authentic in everything we do. And so that being that genuine aspect, and you can't stress it enough. I at Cooperstock, we had a mandate that we would only send out 2 emails a month from a marketing perspective, because I always wanted our emails to kind of come across as special, right? I'm sure if you remember back 6 months ago, you know, United Airlines would send you 4 in a day from different departments, like they were kind of tripping over each other. So we've changed that philosophy now, because everybody's sitting home, and you actually open up every email now because you have you know, a little bit more time sitting in front of your computer. So I guess my point is that incredibly frequent, genuine communication, both to your teams and to your guests, is by far the most important thing you can do. And you hear it. I talk to all of our friend, you know, CEOs and leaders in the industry, and you hear, you know, the good, bad, and ugly, and stating the obvious, the companies that have wonderful, strong cultures, you know, have for sure the best chance at surviving this thing.
Well, Tim, you know, can't thank you enough for spending the time with us today. And the extent people have questions to shoot over to Tim on the portal, feel free to do so. I know you do have a hard stop coming up here, and you know, wishing you and your team at Cooperstock all the best as we work through this, Tim. So thank you again.
Thank you, Riley. I'll stay on as long as I can. And if anybody, if there's ever anything I can do for any one of you individually, you know, just if you don't already have my contact info, Riley, you got my permission to share it with anyone we can help.
Well, be careful what you ask for, Tim, and I will do that. Yeah, I'm sure people have lots of questions. Hey, that's the great thing about this restaurant community we have here. everybody sharing ideas and best practices, and just phenomenal group on the phone and phenomenal group of participants today and every week. So thank you again, Tim, and we will get the good word out there.
Thank you.
All right. Well, we are going to move into the fast and exciting and never-ending world of CARES Act-related guidance that we've been receiving on the topic that everybody's been looking for. It would have been really nice maybe if the government had thought through some of these things before coming out with policies. But, you know, that's kind of the way it goes sometimes. And everybody's moving real fast, and we've got some new developments on forgiveness, which has been... hopefully there will be some forgiveness for lawmakers for putting everybody through this. But Liz, are you here?
Liz Landis.
Liz and Landis, yeah. Terrific. So what's going on with forgiveness? I know it's been all the talk the last 36 hours.
Absolutely, yeah. So late Friday evening, the SBA published its long-awaited PPP loan forgiveness application, as well as some detailed instructions and worksheets to assist borrowers in filling out the application. The SBA also announced that it will issue further guidance and regulations in the near future to further assist borrowers in completing the forgiveness application. They say that every time. It's here's the latest guidance, but don't worry, there's more to come. So, you know, it's as you've noted, that we have to stay on our toes with all of this. Now, there's a lot of good news in the application. So the application form and instructions, they include a number of measures intended by the SBA to reduce compliance burdens and simplify the process for borrowers applying for forgiveness. So we want to highlight a number of those, and then Liz will go into some greater detail. So first off, borrowers will have the option to calculate payroll costs using an alternative payroll covered period that aligns better with the borrower's regular payroll cycles. For example, if your loan was disbursed on May 1st, but your payroll cycle began on May 5th, you can calculate your forgivable spending based on the 8-week period beginning May 5th. So other folks were worried about, well, do I do a partial payroll? You know, how do I even calculate that? So they simplified that. Borrowers will have the flexibility to include eligible payroll and non-payroll expenses on both a paid and incurred basis during the 8-week period after they receive their loans. The SBA provided step-by-step instructions on how to perform the calculations required by the CARES Act to confirm the eligibility for loan forgiveness. So over the weekend, our team prepared an Excel spreadsheet model of the SBA's instructions, which we are willing to share. Now, as noted before, they said that they're going to issue additional guidance. So, you know, the Excel spreadsheet model we've created, it's describing the world as it is today, but we'll update it in the future if they give new guidance. So if anybody wants a copy of that Excel model, just so you can translate the spreadsheet, feel free to email me. My name is Landis Taylor. Email address is landistaylor@bwt.com. So then the SBA adopted certain borrower-friendly terms in the formula that would otherwise cause a reduction in loan forgiveness based on rehiring by June 30th. There was some concern about, you know, well, what happens if you hire everybody back on the last day as opposed to, slowly over the period as you're reopening. Essentially, companies will not be penalized so long as their total FTE count has returned to its previous level by June 30th. We'll explain that a little bit more in a moment. They also added an exemption from the loan forgiveness reduction for borrowers who have made a good faith written offer to rehire workers then the offer was declined. This is consistent with what they had proposed in their FAQ number 40. It is important to note that the forgiveness form requires the company to state whether or not the borrower's PPP loan, together with those of any of its affiliates, is in excess of $2 million in the aggregate. And it also requires the company to make a number of certifications about the accuracy of the information submitted to the application, and also to certify that the funds were only used for authorized purposes and that they're eligible for forgiveness. So essentially, a number of the certifications they required you to make at the time of application, they're required to be remade, and with some other certifications as well, which we'll be analyzing. So Liz, to turn it over to you for some additional details.
Thanks, Landis. So as Landis mentioned, the application in general has provided somewhat more borrower-friendly guidance in terms of timing and eligible expenses for loan forgiveness purposes. In addition to creating this new concept of alternative payroll covered period, which you can elect to follow, or you can, you can stick to the 8 weeks as of loan disbursement. They've interpreted the cost incurred and payments incurred language to be an or payroll cost paid or payroll costs incurred, same for non-payroll cost. And so I think the takeaway from this is that you can get all the costs are eligible that you pay during the period, even if they were incurred before your 8 week period. And also for payroll costs, for any costs that are incurred during your covered period or alternative covered period, they will also count even if you pay them before, as long as you pay them before your next payroll date. And for non-payroll costs.
This is Riley. Hey, I apologize for interrupting. We have State Senator Scott Wiener here for a moment, and he needs to jump quickly. So if we could just pause and I could introduce Senator Wiener, who is behind SB 939. So Senator Wiener, could you hear me?
I can.
Hey, thank you so much for joining the call. Really appreciate it. I know you have just a couple minutes here. Gwyneth was kind enough to go through the proposed bill and a number of questions earlier, but on behalf of our group here, one, we really appreciate your efforts and welcome you to the call to say anything you would like to about the bill. We have restaurant leaders from around the country here that are eagerly watching how this plays out.
Okay, great. Yeah, thank you. My apologies that I called into an emergency meeting on something else. So I'm sorry about being delayed. And I'm Gwyneth, who's been my friend for many years, I'm sure described the bill far better than I ever could. She's amazing to work with and is doing an incredible job organizing the hospitality industry in California during such a difficult time. So thank you, Gwyneth, for everything that you do and being such a great partner. I'll just briefly say I am very, very passionate about making sure that our restaurants and bars and cafes, places of entertainment, can survive this pandemic. Everyone is going through pain right now, but we have to make sure that there is a light at the end of the tunnel. And for our economy, it would be a disaster to see a mass extinction event in the hospitality sector for employment, for economic growth. But I will also say, as someone who also cares deeply about neighborhoods, neighborhood vitality will suffer horribly if we see an enormous number of restaurants, bars, cafes shut down. These are businesses that help define the character and the feel and the soul of a neighborhood. So this matters on so many levels. And this is hard. And the bill that we've introduced, it's a good bill. It's an aggressive bill. And we're not guaranteed by any stretch to get it passed. The real estate industry is pushing back incredibly hard. It'll be a big fight. We're trying to work with them. We would love to be able to come up with a resolution. But it's a real challenging situation. But I think it's a righteous fight. And regardless of what happens, I think we're helping to elevate this conversation and to highlight the fact that there are many good commercial landlords that are working with their tenants to restructure leases. And unfortunately, there are many bad commercial landlords who are not doing that and who are even invoking rent escalators and leases, which is just bizarre to me. So we're going to keep working hard. And again, thank you for all you do for our economy and our community, and just stay strong. I know it is so incredibly hard for these businesses and for their workers and for everyone else, but we're with you and we'll keep fighting. So thank you so much.
Well, Senator Wiener, thank you for leading this fight. I can tell you, you have the support on this call and outside of the restaurant industry. That is also more than willing to be collaborative with landlords to find a workable solution for all. We know it's not as simple as tenants kind of decide that they get what they want. They need to work with landlords, and landlords need to usually work with banks, and banks need to work with government and so forth. So I will tell you, the restaurant community is collaborative. They are willing to work, and they are willing to support this initiative that you are proposing to at least get people to the table to find a workable solution, because we could not agree more that restaurants are the heart and soul of the community, and preserving the jobs in neighborhood restaurants is, you know, an extremely important initiative.
Great. Well, thank you so much, and I apologize for having to run, but enjoy.
Well, thank you, Senator. Gwyneth gave us the information needed to help support this, and anything we can do, feel free to reach out to us anytime. So thank you for taking the time, Senator.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you. All right. Again, if there's any questions for Senator Weiner or for Gwyneth, you can feel free to send those through the porthole. But as the Senator said, this is going to be a fight for obvious reasons, and this is, as always, the time for us as an industry to band together, to be proactive and to find solutions to all the issues we're dealing with. And Liz, apologize for interrupting you on the CARES Act update, but I'll jump back in and talk about forgiveness.
Thanks, Riley. So I was talking about the expansion of costs incurred and payments incurred, costs paid and payments incurred. So it now seems that eligible expenses include any of those expenses paid during the covered period, as well as incurred expenses that you pay for payroll either before the next payroll date and for the other expenses before the next regular billing date. Another kind of change to eligible payroll costs is in the application, they seem to have added a new cap for compensation paid to owners, and this is owner employees, self-employed individuals, or general partners. So there had always been the cap on the 8-week equivalent of $100,000 per year, but now there seems to be a cap on the 8-week equivalent of the owner's applicable compensation in 2019. And so it's a lesser of those two caps. The application goes through, as Landis mentioned, a detailed step-by-step order of how you calculate your forgiveness amount. Before the application had been released, it hadn't been clear which order the rules would apply, such as the 75-25 rule, the FTE reduction, and the salary and wage reduction. At a high level, you take your eligible payroll and non-payroll costs, you then subtract out the salary and wage reductions in excess of 25% on a per employee basis. You then apply the pro rata FTE reduction quotient. And then at the end, you do a check that the resulting amount is not more than the eligible payroll cost divided by 75%. So this order of steps is more borrower friendly than could have been the interpretation. Subtracting out the salary wage reductions before the FTE reduction quotient should result in a higher forgiveness amount. Also adding doing the check of the 75% payroll cost at the end is more favorable than applying that in step one, where you're looking at the overall bucket. And just as an aside, it does seem, it's seeming more likely that more guidance will be coming out, potentially on the 75-25% rule, as well as on the 8-week covered period. It's seeming like that might get extended. So stay tuned for more guidance, as always. As far as FTE reduction calculations go, one of the big questions that people had been asking is, what is a full-time equivalent employee? The application provided that definition. For each employee, you calculate the average number of hours paid per week divided by 40, and then round to the nearest tenth, capped at one FTE per employee. It also provides, you can use that method or you can use a simplified approach that assigns a 1 for employees who work 40 hours or more per week and 0.5 for employees who work fewer hours. I know a lot of people had been thinking it was 30 hours, so it's now clear that it's 40. Also for FTE calculations, the application uses an average weekly number, whereas the Act itself had used a monthly average. In addition to the FTE reduction safe harbor that we've all been discussing and Landis mentioned, whereby you restore your FTE counts by June 30th, the application seems to create a new safe harbor available to borrowers who didn't reduce its number of employees or the average paid hours of their employees between January 1st of this year and the end of their covered period. Also, you know, there's the rehire exception we've been talking about, and for which more guidance has been promised but has not been issued yet, if you make a good faith offer and the employee declines the offer. The application adds another prong to this, where you won't get dinged for employees who during their covered period were fired for cause, voluntarily resign, or voluntarily request and receive a reduction in their hours. And this new exception, along with the rehire exception, is they've made clear is only available to the extent the position was not filled by a new employee. This is kind of a new caveat that we hadn't seen before, and I suspect we'll be seeing guidance giving more details around how this will work. I would also note that the application itself lays out all the documentation that's required, and it's quite a bit, as well as requiring certification, much of which is similar to the certification we saw as part of the loan application, whereas the representative of the borrower has to initial next to many of the certifications, including everything being true as of the date and based on the guidance and laws in place at the time of the loan forgiveness application. Those are kind of the high-level points, and it does clarify quite a few of the questions that people had up to this point, but also, you know, raises more questions, and more guidance will probably address some of them.
Well, thank you so much for the update, Liz, and, you know, maybe speaking for all of us here, as if, you know, this crisis wasn't painful enough having to deal with this guidance from the government. Oh, my gosh. But thank you for everybody who's been dealing with these applications and waiting for this guidance, and the team for giving this guidance and hanging in there. It's obviously very important to get this type of funding, and, you know, it's obviously imperfect too. And, appreciate everybody working through it. Our team obviously is happy to help anybody that has needs getting through this financing piece. Before we jump into the people report, we're also seeing, you know, some traditional financing markets starting to show signs of opening up a little bit. We're seeing more interest from growth investors out there, a little more M&A activity on the horizon. So some bright spots poking through the darkness that we think are going to increase as people get a handle on how things are going. So I think it's refreshing from our perspective on the financing side to see more deal activity looking like it's going to open up, and we really can't wait for that. See some more good stuff happening. So with that, we'll jump right, go around the horn the last few minutes here on some people issues with some opening updates and so forth. Aaron, are you on the line from Los Angeles? Janet on the line from Los Angeles. I don't know if we have Los Angeles on the line today. Why don't I jump over to Roy, New York?
Hi, how you doing? This is Aaron. I'm here.
Oh, hey, Aaron. How are you?
Good. So the quick update in Los Angeles is that the governor has eased the restrictions on opening up in dining. Originally, they were county by county in a very high standard. And the main thing is that the governor eliminated the no COVID-related deaths in the last either week or 14 days. I can't remember the requirement, which would have been very difficult to meet in populous counties like Los Angeles and San Francisco and those areas. So that was changed yesterday. So I believe the last I read, it's 53 of the 58 counties are now moving towards opening up and dining because they can meet the new standard. So that's some good news. And that's about it from LA.
Well, that's really welcome news, because I know that requirement was having people pull their hair out. So exciting to see some better developments there, and I think we're going to see more as well. So thank you.
And Roy in New York, what's going on there?
Hey, Riley. So in New York, the state is starting to reopen. Phase one is now open in all of New York except for the Capital Region, Mid-Hudson, New York City, and Long Island. So unfortunately, if you're in Westchester, New York City, or Long Island, it's still not even at phase one yet. Phase one is construction, manufacturing, curbside retail, things like that. And there must be 14 days in a phase before moving to phase two. And restaurants are in phase three. So it still looks like it's going to be several weeks before restaurants can open in Westchester, New York City, or Long Island. But that doesn't mean that restaurants can't start preparing. The Department of Health this week issued a template safety plan that businesses are supposed to keep. They don't have to turn it in to the government, but they are supposed to keep it and fill it out for themselves. And the template safety plan covers, you know, obvious items such as physical distancing, PPE, and that it would be the employer's cost, hygiene and cleaning requirements, including record keeping requirements, and then logs of employees and visitors with close contact to employees at the location. I think significantly for restaurants, at least the way it stands now, is it excludes customers, but businesses are encouraged to ask them to provide contact info to be logged for contact tracing purposes. But at least for now, restaurants will not be required when they do eventually open up to ask customers for contact information for contact purposes. The Essential Workers Bill of Rights, which was introduced to the City Council a couple weeks ago, which included a just cause discharge requirement and hazard pay, is still working its way through the City Council. And as of now, it is not up for any vote, but we'll continue to update as that law works its way through the system.
Well, thank you, Roy. And Jillian, State of Washington, Seattle, anything going on there worth reporting?
Hey, hi, Riley. Hi, everybody. Just a quick little update. On Friday, the governor rolled back. He had required customers to provide that contact information before being able to be served in a restaurant. It's now strongly encouraged that they do so, and restaurants will still need to ask for that information, but make clear that it's voluntary. If they are provided with that information, they do need to maintain it and turn it over to health officials if there is some sort of exposure. But it's no longer a requirement. And they also provided a link to a little template that you can use that looks just like a little table you'd create on Microsoft Office, but a helpful little resource there. But other than that, folks are just still trying to figure out how to make these new requirements that I talked about last week work, you know, single-use menus, rules around condiment use, 50% occupancy, all those things. So folks are still kind of thinking that through and happy to answer any specific questions offline.
Thank you so much, Jillian. And Jenna, Oregon. Anything worth reporting in Oregon, Jenna? I see you are on mute. While we wait for Jenna here, we also should be getting some opening guidance in the city of Los Angeles shortly. Been working on the opening committee there with a number of restaurateurs. Some of them are on the call today, and we should have some opening guidance soon. Obviously, a very fluid situation, and looking to get California and the rest of the country back and running as soon as possible.
Hey, Riley, sorry about that.
No problem.
So not a ton going on here other than the Wild West, in that there was a judge in Baker County yesterday who ruled that all of the executive orders in Oregon were outside of Governor Brown's authority. And then by 7 o'clock, the Supreme Court had essentially stayed that. And so the executive orders are back in effect until the Supreme Court can hear the arguments and rule. So we are in a little bit of a crazy holding pattern. Hopeful that the courts will get through this pretty quickly and we'll have an answer to this question by the end of next week. But I would expect that we'll see more litigation in the near future, trying to invalidate the executive orders as people are kind of trying to push out of all of this. So we'll be keeping track and letting you all know what the results are.
Well, thank you, Jenna. And you know, I think the takeaways from today's calls that we've been seeing evolving over the last several weeks is that you know, now is more important than ever for restaurants to be working together and collaboratively and to be working with lawmakers. Really appreciate the initiative by Senator Wiener and that what Gwyneth are working on there, as well as other lawmakers working on policies to keep restaurants in business, to support the owners and the employees. And it's going to take a lot of collaboration to make this work with landlords and with banks and with the government. And that's the path ahead to see through it. So there's a lot of work going on along the sidelines, and the more active that we can all be in that conversation from the restaurant leader side, the better the results are going to be. So I'd really like to thank Gwyneth and Senator Wiener for lending their time to today's program. The information is online here. If you want to reach out to her to voice your support, we certainly encourage you to do so, as well as to Chef J.J. Johnson from Field Trip and Tim McHenry from Cooper's Hawk. So thank you again, everybody, for spending your time today. We look forward to seeing you again next week. In the interim, wishing you and your families and teams the best of health. So thank you again. We will see you next week.